Do achy, stiff joints slow you down? Would you like to put some of the cushion back in your joints and cartilage? Would you like to clinically reduce everyday joint aches and pains? Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and if you answered yes, then good news. Our friends at Purity Products want to send you a bottle of their legendary Ultimate HA joint formula for just $9. Ultimate HA features the joint-boosting benefits of hyaluronic acid. HA works like a shock absorber, helping you to cushion and soothe your joints. Plus, this HA also hydrates your skin, and people say they look better too. Just a few capsules a day, and you deliver powerful support for your joints, cartilage, skin, and connective tissue. So call 1-800-983-1154 and get a full-size bottle of HA7 for only $9, and you also get free shipping. Call now to claim your $9 trial bottle of HA7 with free shipping. 1-800-983-1154. These move fast, so call now. 1-800-983-1154. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're talking to one of the foremost advocates of a low-carb dietary approach to diabetes, to weight loss. He is a professor of cell biology at the State University of New York and author and editor of a comprehensive review of dietary carbohydrate restriction as the first approach in diabetes management. We talked about that in part one. And he's got a new book entitled Nutrition in Crisis. And the idea is about the ascendancy of the low-carb diet in the face of some powerful forces that seek to push back on that truth. So I just want to start out by saying that there is this thing called biochemical individuality, which means that, you know, different strokes for different folks. Is it possible that a small subset of people, or maybe even a larger subset of people, are more vulnerable to the effects of fats and that they do better on low-fat diets? And maybe that's why there's confusion when the studies get looked at. You know, some studies say yay, some studies say nay about the value of ketogenic diets or low-fat diets. I'm sorry, low-carb diets.
No, absolutely. In fact, one of the problems with the diet hard hypothesis and the obsession with saturated fat is that we won't know what the risks are with saturated fat. We can't say there are none. All we can say is that when they tried to show risk across the board, it wasn't there. But you're right.
There wasn't a strong enough signal if you look at 10,000 people, but maybe there's a subset of 300 people or 500 people who may be very vulnerable to those effects, but they get washed out in the noise.
Yeah. I mean, let me say that, in terms of your introduction, I'm not actually an advocate for anything.
Okay. Fair enough.
I think what we've shown is that your best approach in diabetes or metabolic syndrome is a low carbohydrate diet. If it doesn't work, or you don't like it, or you can switch to something else. But people talk about individuality, but you have to start someplace. And in diabetes, you start with a low carb diet. At the same time, I think there's nothing better for weight loss, but there's a million ways to lose weight, especially if you're young. And I think a low-carb diet is a good way to start, but everybody has their own thing. And we don't know what causes heart disease. We know things that may be relevant, but what we know is that there doesn't appear to be any risk to heart disease from doing a low-carb diet. And because of the importance of insulin in so many aspects, it's a reasonable place to start. So, yes, your answer is absolutely right. Individuals may respond in different ways. Especially in heart disease, where we have a lot of confounders.
Is there hope that in the future we may develop such a sophisticated science that using nutrigenomics, genetic profiling, and/or metabolomics, we can sort of sort it out. We can say, well, look, you're a person who's going to do well on a very low-fat diet, and alternatively, another person might do well on carb restriction. Is that something that you can envision based on, you know, your understanding of biochemistry?
To a large extent, yeah, I think that's that will be the direction that we go. I don't. I mean, there is the problem with heart disease in particular that it may be sort of chaotic in the mathematical sense. You know, the
multifactorial and, you know.
Yeah, the description that a butterfly flapping its wings on one continent will cause a tornado on another continent. Mm-hmm. So we do have that, but I think there is a lot of hope for that. The problem is far more complicated in cancer.
Yeah. Let's focus on cancer, because tell us about your work on keto diets for cancer with Dr. Eugene Fine at my alma mater, Albert Einstein College of Medicine. That's where I went to med school. It's interesting that they're doing nutrition work on cancer.
Dr. Fine is the PI on this project, which he did a pilot study on it's a small study, safety and feasibility study on 10 patients with advanced cancer. So the patients had to either have failed or refused chemotherapy to get into this study. So it was, as they call it, safety and feasibility. They did okay. And
I always find that that's unfortunate when they sort of relegate to nutrition the very dregs of the cancer establishment, because it's like, okay, you failed everything, you're on your last legs, you're terminal. Okay, now let's try nutrition. I mean, but I guess that's for feasibility study. It's not necessarily
For a study that's reasonable for a patient. There's no one of the things about ketogenic diets for cancer, for any number of diseases, is that we get anecdotal studies that are very dramatic. And because they're anecdotal, you don't necessarily know where to go with them. But what they do tell you is that they're safe. And so there's no real risk in being on a ketogenic diet. In fact, the barrier is to this is that we all misunderstood or didn't pay attention to ketogenic diets, because we, in medical school, they're generally taught as the a side effect of
ketoacidosis.
Right. Untreated type 1 diabetes.
Right. And those tend to be conflated as, you know, ketogenic diet and ketosis versus ketoacidosis, which is a very dangerous, put patients in the ICU kind of situation.
Yeah. But ketone bodies are regulated by insulin. If you have type 1 diabetes, you don't have insulin, and the there's a feedback loop. Fatty acids break down. Fat breaks down to fatty acids. Fatty acids are converted to ketone bodies. Ketone bodies stimulate the release of insulin, which represses the breakdown of fat. So it's regulating its own synthesis. If you don't have insulin, then you will have a problem. But we misunderstood the effect of ketone bodies themselves, and still don't know that much about it. But if you step back 1 second and think, our forefathers did not get 3 square meals a day. They lived on ketone bodies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, starvation is very paleo. It's part of our ancestral heritage.
Exactly. I mean, I always, paleo is keto. Mm-hmm. So that is the problem. We misunderstood that, all of us, and underestimated its importance.
So with the cancer work, I've heard the theory, you know, we actually have had Dr. Thomas Seyfried on as a guest on a couple of occasions here, which is kind of dates back to the work of Otto Warburg, who won the Nobel Prize, I guess, way back when, 1910 or something like that, or perhaps in the 1930s, I'm not even sure. But the idea that you are essentially starving the cancer cell of its sustenance when you feed it fat in the absence of carbs. So is that how it works? Or is it really that simple and elegant?
You know, cancer's answer is always not so fast.
Right.
It's a very tough nut to crack. I mean, we are, one of the things going on in our lab is we have a kind of we have an instrument that is kind of a robotic Warburg apparatus, and so we can get a indication of what kind of metabolism is going on. You know, the metabolism is basically energy metabolism is basically two blocks. We convert glucose and other foods into a compound called acetyl-CoA. So if anybody who studied freshman chemistry remembers acetic acid.
Right, you're giving me nightmares again, because that was one of the worst summers of my life when I took about two semesters of biochemistry as a cram course prior to med school.
Undoubtedly you remember the part where acetyl-CoA goes into oxidative metabolism that uses oxygen, whereas glycolysis, that's the part that doesn't require oxygen.
Which is for fermentative metabolism.
Right. Actually, you know, the glycolysis, I always said, I don't know whether this is really helpful, but glycolysis is the process that converts glucose to pyruvate or pyruvic acid. Mm-hmm. And I always tell students that etymology will tell you something, because pyre is the same root as fire.
Right.
As pyromaniac. And uvo in Romance languages means grapes. So pyruvic acid comes from firing grapes. In other words, fermentation.
Cool. That's a cool mnemonic. But so that's sort of the gateway to the Krebs cycle.
Right.
But cancer cells are thought to operate at a different level, at a more primitive level. They don't have that capacity. They don't have the mitochondrial mojo to utilize fat as a substrate. And so they're sugar dependent, something along those lines.
I'll tell you what Warburg found. He grew cancer cells, and the pyruvate can either go into acetyl-CoA and the oxidative metabolism. And then when you have oxidative metabolism, of course, you make CO2, carbon dioxide.
Right.
But when you're not running that, or not running it well, the pyruvate is converted to lactic acid.
Okay.
So, again, it's fermentation, but it's the same fermentation that goes on in your yogurt.
Exactly. Right? And that's why you get that tart taste in yogurt, the acid edophilus, right?
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
So what Warburg found is that if he measured the amount of lactic acid as an indication of glycolysis, and he measured the amount of CO2, the ratio was much higher in cancer cells.
Okay.
And he thought that was a feature of cancer cells. The Cori's, you may remember from biochemistry, the Cori cycle.
Yep.
Anyway, Gertie Cori was a very important biochemist. And what she did is she, following up on Warburg, she got a chicken with a tumor in one of its forelimbs, and she stuck a tube in both forelimbs, the one with the cancer and the one with the one that was normal. And then she looked at how much CO2 and how much lactate was in there. And she found the same thing that Warburg had found, that the cancer cells seemed to be running fermentation rather than oxidative metabolism, even though there was oxygen there. So, I mean, that's the important point. Cells can switch, but
right
here. So I think that's come to be a renewed interest. It's a little bit of an exaggeration, unfortunately. Some cancers don't show a Warburg effect.
Mm-hmm.
For example, most prostate cancers do not show that. And one of the tip-offs is that if you look at the relation between cancer and diabetes, there's a good correlation for most cancers in susceptibility to cancer in people with diabetes. Uh-huh. It's not true in prostate cancer. It even goes the other way. So we right off, we expect that if we get anything out of ketogenic diets, that's not going to be the one that's going to work out.
So this is envisioned as a adjunctive therapy, clearly. It's not, you know, some miracle cure, you know, people with advanced metastatic cancer all just all go on a ketogenic diet. It's all going to, you know, shrink and disappear, although there may be some response. It's a way to attenuate the cancer, maybe so that it becomes more vulnerable to other more targeted therapies, perhaps.
Well, that's one of the things we're working on in my lab, and Gene has just told me about studies he's done up at Einstein with in rats. But I'll tell you about the tissue culture stuff that we're doing. We showed that several different cancers would be inhibited in their growth and their generation of ATP. ATP, you know, is considered a kind of energy molecule. And that they were inhibited by acetoacetate, which is one of the ketone bodies. Mm-hmm. Now, lately we were studying some cytotoxic agents, agents that would really kill cancer, such as rapamycin and methotrexate. Methotrexate inhibits the...
folate cycle.
Right. And the principle is that you need to run folate to make... the base thymidine, if you know, most people are familiar with the bases in DNA, A, T, C, and G, and T is, to make T requires one of the folic acid derivatives. And they have many forms, but if you inhibit one of the reactions with methotrexate, then that slows DNA synthesis down. The problem is that maybe in some sense the problem with all cancers is that they're both extremely dangerous and extremely normal. So it's hard to get at them without hurting normal cells. So the problem in methotrexate therapy or all the chemotherapy is the side effects.
With collateral damage, yeah.
And they can be drastic, you know. We asked the question, if a patient's on a ketogenic diet, could they do with less of these cytotoxic agents, thereby reducing side effects? And so what we have, now this is a tissue culture study, it's in a dish, and we found that we need much less rapamycin or much less methotrexate if the we also put in acetoacetate. So acetoacetate does not kill the cells. It slows down their growth. They're in a more static state. But then much less of these cytotoxic agents will kill them.
So that's encouraging. That actually suggests that there may be a role, if only ancillary, of very low-carb diets or ketogenic diets in support of cancer patients. It's just a question of, you know, where it can be applied. Different cancers may have different characteristics. Even the same type of cancer at a different stage in its development in a different person may respond differently. So we need, I guess, ways to identify which cancers are most susceptible to this, because it is a bother. It's not, you know, it's a big undertaking to go on a ketogenic diet.
Exactly. We don't even know sometimes in the same tissue whether it's the same cancer.
Yeah, there's a lot of polygenetic cancers, multiple genetic sequences within even a single tumor. I just wanted to finish this by saying you actually have been very active teaching in medical school. And one of the questions I had when I was learning biochemistry in medical school and physiology was I found it very boring because it was very theoretical. We were just talking about pathways, and I well, I was already interested in nutrition at the time, so I applied the biochemistry to problems of ordinary nutrition, proteins, carbohydrates, vitamins, minerals. That kind of invigorated it for me. So why do you think that hasn't taken hold in medical schools even now? There's very little nutrition teaching.
I don't know the answer to those things. I think things move slowly. Part of it is that the curriculum in medical school is so extensive. I mean, our students are so good. I'm amazed that they can learn all the stuff they do learn.
But we're feeding them like Strasbourg geese, you know, all this information. And maybe 1% of the time is allocated to nutrition, which I think deserves primacy in training a physician.
Yeah. Well, I can only say that downstate, we try to do that. The question is how much time you can spend on it and where does it take? And also there's the basic idea of medical school, which is about drugs.
Yeah, and the pharmacological paradigm, right?
Yeah. Drugs and surgery. And that's what, and of course, that's been fantastically successful. I mean, modern medicine, its successes are very great. So that makes it, you know, tough to get new stuff into it. But the resistance of the medical establishment does not help. I can tell you that.
That's for sure. What sort of professional pushback have you encountered because of your somewhat iconoclastic views about nutrition? I mean, have you found that you've been shunned or at various times maybe quarantined because you take a different approach?
It's very difficult to get papers published.
Yeah.
And it's impossible to get, it used to be impossible to get funded for low-carb studies from the NIH. I mean, I was, I'm trained, as you mentioned, as a protein chemist, and I was funded for 19 years by the National Heart and Lung Institute. But the last time, they wouldn't fund our cancer study, and they wouldn't even give me $10,000 to run a conference on low carb diet. So,
wow.
And it's very hard to get published. And, but now, there's a lot of confusion, as we were talking about before, that low carb is clearly demonstrating its value. It's no longer the stepchild. And at the same time, or possibly as a consequence of that, you have really, I mean, you really have vicious response. My book, the new chapter in my book describes the attack of the medical establishment on their own people, on doctors and health providers. And so it's really, can't say it's the discouraging part of what's a mixed bag. In terms of personal interactions, I may have a personality disorder anyway. You know, I come from Brooklyn, so.
That makes you an automatic pariah, I think.
Yeah.
But it also puts you in a distinguished cadre of individuals, because the folks who went to Brooklyn public schools back in the 50s and 60s and, you know, went to, you know, came out of that culture, some of them became, you know, real top leaders in medicine and politics and in finance in America. So you're a special breed of cat, and also
not to mention Murder Incorporated.
Right, exactly. We're talking about the Brooklyn Dodgers, but you know, just
well, I used to be the editor of Nutrition and Metabolism Journal, which is published in England, and I used to argue a little bit with the publisher. Who I never met, but one of them told me on the phone that he thought I was a cross between Woody Allen and Tony Soprano. So
I guess that's high praise coming from an Englishman.
Yeah, I took it as
well. Good stuff. Okay, so let's give our audience some resources. First of all, the new book, it's actually a complete update of the previous book. It's called Nutrition in Crisis, and it's available from Amazon. The author, our guest, Dr. Richard David Feynman. And Dr. Feynman, you got a website as well with a lot of your blogs and information. So yeah, what's that, please?
FeynmanTheOther.com.
FeynmanTheOther. And that is because of the peculiar fact that you are often confused with Dr. Richard Feynman, who is the author of some wonderful aphorisms. I use his quotes all the time. That's spelled differently. It's F-E-Y-N-M-A-N. So
That's why I adopted. I was encouraged to start using my middle name so as to, as they say, disambiguate myself from his name. It hasn't really done much for my career. I'm thinking of changing my name to Richard deGrasse Feynman.
There you go.
But, so it's FeynmanTheOther.com, and it's that's my blog. It's been a little bit inactive, but I'm about to start posting some things right away because of some of the recent stuff that it came out.
Well, great stuff. Congratulations on your wonderful work, your wonderful career, and also your iconoclasm and your courage in bucking the trend in the field of nutrition and just using good science. And I think, you know, you're not carrying water for one side or the other, but I think you're just aiming for the truth. And the truth, you know, fortunately, the tide is turning because as you once said, that 2018 was the year of low carb, and 2019 is certainly following in that trend. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Feynman.
Well, thanks for the opportunity.
My pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. If you happen to be on a weight loss regimen, studies show that as fat cells shrink, they release stored toxins into the system that can actually poison metabolic pathways and slow your metabolism, causing your weight to plateau even in the face of stringent diet adherence. That's why I've created the Intelligent Medicine Detox Protocol, a collection of carefully curated supplements to mobilize toxin elimination, easing the blahs that sometimes compromise your dietary resolve. The Intelligent Medicine Detox Protocol is an easy way to get the exact combination of the targeted nutrients you need. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com for more information and to purchase. Plus, you'll find easy-to-follow links to our heart health and immunity protocols and much more. And for a limited time, you'll get free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com.